This is Mark Strassman, a reporter with Etopia Media Medical News Network. We're about to speak to Lee Morris, who's the president of Iatrogen. We're going to talk to him about his RxWise product. Welcome to Etopia Media Medical News Network.
Thank you.
Give us a little background about the company, starting with the origin of the name, Iatrogen.
Well, Iatrogen actually comes from the word iatrogenic, which means treatment-induced. A treatment-induced disease is an iatrogenic disease, and an adverse drug reaction is an iatrogenic outcome to the use of a medicine. So we took the name from the Latin word meaning treatment-induced disease.
Okay, and tell us about the RxWise product. What's it designed to do?
It's designed to empower consumers to be more alert to and aware of the risks of adverse drug reactions from the increasing number of prescription, non-prescription, and herbal medicines that the average consumer is taking today.
How frequent are adverse drug reactions, or ADRs?
Actually, they're more frequent than most folks realize. Today, it's believed to be the fourth, the fifth leading cause of death in the United States, over 100,000 deaths a year just among hospitalized patients. And about 7% of all hospitalizations are the result of an avoidable outpatient adverse drug reaction.
Could you give us some striking examples of the most common problems? Are these essentially reactions that take place in anyone who takes a certain combination of drugs?
Well, I think first of all, you raise an important point. There's a difference between a risk for an adverse drug reaction and a drug interaction.
Right.
When you talk about people taking multiple medicines at the same time, you're talking about a concern for drug interactions. And though it's an important concern, it only really amounts to about 15 to 20% of the illnesses that result from the inappropriate use of prescription medicines.
So you're saying most adverse drug reactions are to a single drug.
In combination with that drug's relationship to the diseases that you're being treated for.
Right.
And that's an important difference because most every community pharmacy in the country today, retail or chain, offers drug interaction monitoring there at the pharmacy. So most folks are confused as to what they're getting at the pharmacy and what they would be getting from RxWise.
Okay, well, can you explain the difference?
Sure. A drug interaction would be, for example, to take a drug like aspirin together with a drug like Coumadin. That drug is used by people who have heart disease to need to thin their blood. And that blood thinning effect is potentiated, that is, it's made worse, by the interaction between aspirin and Coumadin. That's a classic drug interaction. And these people who take these medicines together are at risk for increased bleeding because the Coumadin becomes more effective in the presence of aspirin.
Okay, so tell me now what RxWise is designed to avoid.
Well, RxWise monitors those things, but let's stay in the cardiovascular area and let's talk about medicines that interfere, for example, with the body's ability to remove water. Many medicines, for example, the very common medicines that most people use for arthritis management are sodium retentive. That is, they cause the body to retain water. People who are hypertensive will have their hypertension worsen, likely as a result of this increased fluid retention. It's almost like taking a tablespoon of salt, that it causes fluid to be retained. So we advise people who have a history of hypertension that the medicines that they're taking can make their hypertension worse. So it's not really an interaction with another medicine, but indeed in this case an interaction with the disease they're being treated for.
Okay, so is RxWise designed to warn people about drug interaction problems or adverse drug reactions in general?
It does both. It is a system which powerfully looks at the most important drug interactions and advises folks about that, but it also focuses on drug disease complications, which are more implicated often with severe outcomes that require remedial physician intervention and hospitalization.
Okay, and how much of this a warning is already handled by the systems that are in place in pharmacies?
About 15%. So they're going to get those 15% of the cases where there is a risk for a drug interaction.
Don't the pharmacies routinely have software and a database to tell people who are getting Coumadin, for example, that they shouldn't take aspirin or any of the more complicated ones that we might talk about here?
Yes, they do. Those are the 15% I'm talking about, the drug interactions that contribute to serious adverse effects.
And what's the other 85%?
The complications between the drug that someone is taking and the diseases that they're being treated for.
Oh.
See, with the Coumadin example, it's not that there's a complication with respect to the fact that they have cardiovascular disease.
Right.
It's a simply chemical relationship between aspirin and Coumadin. In the example that I gave you with the antiarthritic medicines, the problem is an exacerbation of the hypertension that the patient has.
Right, but my question is, don't the systems that are in place in pharmacies that have records of all the drugs that a particular patient is purchasing alert the pharmacist to alert the patient about all possible adverse combination effects of drugs that are being prescribed for them?
Unfortunately not. Unfortunately, they are programmed to look at drug interactions only, and none that I'm aware of, and I do a lot of work in this space, actually look at drug disease risks. And frankly, because largely the pharmacies don't know what diseases patients are being treated for. The data contained in the pharmacy systems are usually just prescription drug information.
So you're saying that the systems that are in place in pharmacies, are they required by law, by the way?
They're not required by law, per se, but I can't think of any pharmacy that would operate absent at least a basic system of drug interaction monitoring.
So the system of drug interaction monitoring will tell a patient if they're getting drug A and drug B and that those have some potentiating effect or other or depotentiating effect, the patients will be alerted to that by the pharmacy without using RxWise.
That's correct.
So what's the advantage then and point of getting the RxWise product?
Because the RxWise product gathers disease history information and incorporates that into the risk assessment. So it does both drug interaction risk assessment and it does drug disease interaction assessment. So the patient is getting a much more robust analysis of their risks for an adverse drug reaction.
And you're saying that the pharmacy systems typically don't cover this interaction between the drug and the medical condition effects.
Yes, sir, that's correct.
Okay.
One additional benefit to the RxY system is that there is increasing evidence in the literature today, in the medical literature today, that serious adverse drug reaction risks are brought about by the consumer's self-medication using over-the-counter medicines and herbal medicines. There is a significant increase in consumer use of over-the-counter medicines and herbal medicines over the past couple of decades.
And, of course, neither of those are monitored by the drug interaction software and database of the pharmacist.
Absolutely, they're not, because that information is never entered by the pharmacist, so it would never have an opportunity to go through the pharmacy system.
Increasingly widespread is self-medication with herbal remedies?
Well, it's increasing. I think that the latest information that I've seen suggests that upwards about 20 to 25% of Americans are using some form of herbal medicines today. That's up from less than 5% 10 years ago.
Okay. Now, how likely are different demographic groups to have these problems?
Well, I think the issue of demography tends more to be related to the age of the patient.
Okay.
Occasionally the sex of the patient, because certain prescription medicines that women take in particular have inherent increased risks for adverse drug reactions. But the most significant demographic risk factor is, of course, age. These folks have reduced liver function. They have reduced renal function. Both those mechanisms are necessary to clear drugs out of the human body, and when those functions are compromised, as they are oftentimes in the elderly, those medicines hang around for a long time. And the axiom is the longer the medicine is active in your bloodstream, the longer you are exposed to the risk of an adverse effect.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about the development of the RxWise product, but before you do that, tell us the form factor that people can buy it in.
Well, the product is offered to the consumers in two different formats. The first is a portable flash drive. Many of your listeners probably have seen or used these. They're sometimes known as thumb drives. They're about the size of your thumb. And on that, we not only store all of the software necessary to perform these analyses, but the patient's self-reported history, the drugs they're taking and the diseases they're presenting with. The neat thing about that is that they can wear it on a lanyard, which we provide, and take it with them to their doctor and take it with them to their pharmacist. Because what's very important for your listeners to understand is that this product only works best when it's used in conjunction with the advice that consumer is getting from their healthcare providers. It is not intended to be used by consumers alone, absent the advice and counsel of their healthcare provider.
So you're saying it can be used in the flash drive form for patients to enter data into their computer, store it in the flash drive, and bring that to the pharmacist and or physician?
Exactly, because that's where the true discussion can be had with respect to, is this risk worth it? You know, we have to be careful in communicating with consumers that they need to understand that there is an inherent risk to all medicines, and that risk in and of itself is not necessarily bad. It's when the risk of an adverse effect so outweighs the opportunity for beneficial effect, then we need to evaluate the medicine. Many times, physicians are agonized over the decision, do I treat this with this medicine and take this risk, or do I take another route? The neat thing about education, medical education today in this country, is that physicians are frankly very well trained to make that risk-benefit decision. The reason that it's not made more often is that they don't have all of the patient's medical history in front of them and are not focused on it at the time many medicines are prescribed. And we think the RxWise product, or the output of the RxWise product, will enable physicians to focus on that risk-benefit decision.
On the hardware side, or on the procedural side, are pharmacies and physicians' offices routinely equipped to deal with flash drives and accept the information in them?
Well, our surveys of physician groups around the country suggest they are. Most physicians have contemporary computers in their offices that have the USB port, and that's the requisite for using the flash drive. The alternate form that this product can be delivered on is a web page. It's a web-enabled form of the product, and we're gauging from our responses to our surveys that today about 60 to 70% of physicians have web access from their office. And so we think there are probably more computers with USB drives than there are today physicians who have access to the web. The same is true in the pharmacy. These pharmacists have computers with USB drives, and a large number of them also have access to the web.
Okay. Talk about the development of this product. Who developed it, over what time frame, and how did it come to be commercialized through your company?
Well, the technology behind RxWise has been in development and refinement over the course of the past 25 to 30 years. back in the 80s, we were involved with helping the Food and Drug Administration build the early adverse drug reaction forecasting systems that today the FDA uses. And so over the course of the past 25 years, we have both developed and refined the underlying design and software logic that drives the RxWise product. In 2001, after a successful spring of our company in the company we merged into in 1999, we thought that it would be important to try to recharacterize our technology focused on the consumer. Historically, before that, all of the earlier versions of the underlying technology were directed to physicians and to insurance companies and the hospitals, and were not designed to enable consumers to look at this issue. So beginning in 2001, we undertook a major redesign of the technology to simplify it in a way that would promote its use by consumers.
Okay, well, that leads to the next question. How do consumers use it?
Well, whether they have acquired the USB drive or they're using the web-based version, the very first thing they do is they do their own brown bag survey. That may be a term that that you've heard of, where they simply empty out their medicine cabinet, put it on the counter in their kitchen or in their dining room, and sit down with their computer with the USB drive inserted or logged onto the web page, and begin to translate the names on each of the bottles of medicines they have into the software. And that can and that must be both the prescription medicines they're taking and also all of the over-the-counter medicines that they're routinely taking. Once they finish that, they move on to their disease and condition history.
Now, does, in terms of the drugs, is the system prepared to deal with brand names and generics, both?
Absolutely. Both are there. And so they just simply need to read the name of the drug off the bottle, whether it's generic or trade name. They'll find it in the pull-down windows that our software opens up. So they simply find it and click on it.
So they're not going to have to type in complicated drug names?
No, because one, it's so easy to make a typographical error, and two, that's a lot of work, and we want this process to last less than 5 minutes.
So it involves drop-down menus and clicking rather than typing?
Absolutely. The most number of letters that you have to type to get to any drug in any condition is about three.
How many drugs are listed in your database?
Well, there are probably about 30,000 prescription medicines and about that many combined over-the-counter and herbal medicines.
You're saying there are 60,000 drugs out there people could be taking?
Well, when you look at it on a trade name-specific basis, when you collapse that on a generic basis, of course, there are much less because there are many branded forms of the same generic drug.
Right.
When you disaggregate it on a branded basis, you're looking at about 60,000 drugs roughly in the U.S. pharmacopeia.
Okay. That's more than have ever been available in the history of the world, aren't they?
I think so. And indeed, that's one of the calamities here. The average American today, believe it or not, is taking an average of about 10 prescriptions a year, or 10 medicines, I should say, a year. And the
10 different medicines.
10 different medicines, that's correct. They could take one medicine every month for 12 months, but
right.
That only counts as one medicine.
Right.
But what's interesting is that the risk of an adverse drug reaction increases exponentially above four different medicines. And so patients taking four different medicines over the course of the year or greater stand an exponentially higher risk of an adverse drug reaction.
Okay, so back to how the patient is using it. They use the drop-down menus and they indicate all the drugs they're taking and presumably the dosages as well?
The dosages aren't as important because the dosages don't really relate a lot to the conflicts with the diseases they're taking.
Okay.
And plus, in order to have relevant dosing risk assessment, you also then have to get information about body weight and height.
So you're saying really the dose doesn't matter, it's the existence or the presence of the drug in the system in any amount.
That's correct, because typically they're taking the medicine as it's prescribed,
right.
And it's unlikely they would report voluntarily their abuse of the medicine. So
right.
As a result, I think we assume the standard dosing of the medicine prescribed for the patient's age and sex.
When you're saying report, this is essentially reporting to themselves. Does this information go into any personally identifiable database?
It does not, though. That's true mostly for the USB drive version. When they unplug it from their computer and put it in their pocket, that's where all that history is located.
What about the web version?
In the web version, it goes into a secured site that's managed for us by one of the country's leading software engineering groups and internet service providers down in Tampa, Florida.
But the data is associated with the correct personal identifiers of the user?
It is, so that when the patient re-logs on, the next time they want to use it, all of their history is there.
Okay. Are there any potentials for abuse of that information, and what protections are you putting in place to ensure against that?
Well, we guarantee full compliance with federal requirements under the Health Information Privacy Act, known as HIPAA.
Right.
And HIPAA prescribes extremely rigorous software and network and security controls in order to satisfy their audit requirements, and we do satisfy the federal HIPAA audit requirements.
So in no sense, for example, people taking a certain kind of pain reliever are not going to be receiving promotional consideration from alternative providers of similar medication?
Absolutely not. In fact, for clients who come to our webpage, they'll notice that we have a certification on our website called the Honor Code Certification, which is based in Geneva, Switzerland, which stipulates that we comply with a no advertising and no data sales or transfer obligation. We do not permit advertising on our site, and we do not share our data with anyone.
Okay, go back then again to the patient as they've put in all of their drugs. What do they do next?
Well, they save it. So the first thing we want them to do, so they don't have to enter it a second time, is to click on the save button, and that puts it into the system so that it's accessible to them the next time they use it.
Right.
Then either they're contemplating taking a prescription medicine or they see a prescription medicine advertised on television that they wonder if that's a good medicine for them to be taking.
First, though, what do they have to do in terms of self-reporting their own medical conditions?
That's correct. The process is identically the same as the process they went through with their drugs. They simply use a pull-down window and they list the conditions or diagnoses for which they're being treated.
Do people always know that?
You know, it's interesting. It surprised us just how knowledgeable people are today about the conditions they're being treated for. A lot of that's because of the emphasis on claim submission for insurance companies that today we find that most Americans have a pretty good idea of the major diseases for which they're being treated. And this system only requires that they identify it at that level. So we're not getting into the degree of granularity that one would have to have a healthcare background to understand, but do they have diabetes? Do they have asthma? Do they have hypertension? Do they have congestive heart failure?
Okay, now you're talking there, and you've listed examples of essentially persistent chronic conditions.
That's correct.
How does having the flu figure into all of this, which comes and goes?
Well, it does, but you actually raise an extremely important point. I don't know if you did it on purpose or not, but the flu and the management of the flu has enormous potential implications to a risk for an adverse drug reaction. So let's say that a consumer bought this for one of their children, and one of their children came down with the flu. And so the consumer decided then that they were going to give their child aspirin for the flu.
Right.
Well, there is a major risk for certain viral flus if you give somebody aspirin, and indeed...
this is Reye's syndrome.
It's exactly right. Of course, you understand this. And so something as benign and otherwise uneventful as the flu has important implications. It's in the software, and if you acquired this for a child and the child has the flu, you would list that, and then you would list aspirin or Tylenol or something else and see which of any of the analgesics you're contemplating giving your child bears any risk.
Now, speaking of children, is one purchase of this system, does that enable a person to use it for multiple people in a family?
It, again, to remain HIPAA compliant, we must have either a USB drive per person so that the data is unique and controllable by that person. Even though they're a young person, they are entitled to certain protections under HIPAA. And the same is true for the website.
So so a family of four needs to buy four of these?
Either needs to buy four USB drives or needs to have four separate logons to the web product.
Do they get? We haven't talked about the pricing, but maybe we could do that now and explain whether there's a discount for multiple purchases in a single family or a group.
Well, there isn't a discount, though our current marketing strategy is working through large employer groups around the country, and employer groups offer it to their employees at substantial discount.
And you essentially sell them a site license.
We sell them the right to market to their population at a substantial discount. A lot of that discount then is paid for by the employer. So, for example, if an employer wants to take 50% off the price of the product, so that the consumer saves 50% over the retail price we offer it, that 50% difference is made up by the employer.
What is the retail price?
The retail price for the USB product is $39.95, and the retail price for the web-enabled product is $24. That's an annual price, but for the USB drive, because part of that initial price is the cost of the drive, the renewals for the USB drive folks drops to $19 a year.
Okay. Let's continue with the process for the patient who's put in the drug information, put in the medical information. What happens next?
Well, then they list or they inquire on a particular medicine or set of medicines that they're contemplating taking.
Now, presumably the system would then alert people if there's already some problem in what they're taking. They ask for about a new one.
Well, that's right, and that's again a good point that you're making, because most of these people have never even had their baseline group of medicines analyzed. The very first thing the system does is it analyzes the medicines they say they're already taking.
Okay, let's say they're taking Coumadin and aspirin. What does it tell them?
Well, it's going to give them a red alert. That is the top level alert in our system. That's going to tell them of that particular drug interaction, and that it's essential that they communicate with their doctor or pharmacist about this.
And presumably stop. Stop taking aspirin, stop taking Coumadin, or does it call your pharmacist or doctor?
It doesn't say stop taking it, and this is a very, very important point for your readership to understand. It is possible, and frankly, I believe likely, that the physician has already taken into consideration that you're a chronic aspirin user. Perhaps you have severe headaches frequently, or you have arthritis, and aspirin is part of your regimen. So your doctor will titrate. That means that they'll balance the amount of Coumadin they give you with the amount of aspirin you're taking, but it's perfectly at balance.
So there may be no problem.
That's right. And so if you were to stop taking your aspirin,
you wouldn't have enough Coumadin.
That's right. It's exactly right. So I underscored this point that I made earlier. The consumer is not to act unilaterally. This is to raise this issue. This is to say, Dr. Jones, is my current Coumadin dose based on my use of the aspirin, and if I should ever stop taking my aspirin, or if I should double my dose of aspirin, should I let you know? What does all this mean? Most of the time, that sort of titration process goes on without the patient understanding it, and then the doctor loses track of the patient, and that's when these kind of problems occur. So one, we want to be sure that that titration has occurred. It could be that the patient wasn't on aspirin 3 years ago when they started taking the Coumadin and now has begun that. It's an over-the-counter medicine. Doctor doesn't know anything about it. But we don't want it stopped until the physician is consulted so that if it has been titrated, we don't create a problem by discontinuing a medicine. There are many examples of that where discontinuing a medicine can be as dangerous, if not more dangerous, than adverse drug reaction risk.
For example, discontinuing in the case that we're using here, aspirin, which would then lead to not enough blood thinning.
That's correct.
What overall has been the reaction of physicians to this product?
The reaction has been quite positive. It's been positive because it has, one, brought a lot of important risk elements to light that were missed either in the initial patient histories or where the patient has modified their medication use sort of on their own going forward. There is, of course, an enormous exposure for physicians for malpractice liability, and oftentimes the courts and juries don't look closely enough to see that it wasn't the physician's fault at all, but that the patient had acted in some way unanticipated by the doctor.
So you see the use of this product essentially as a catalyst for pharmacists, patients, and doctors to pay more attention to drug interactions.
Absolutely. And indeed, for physicians, a way for them to get on top of some of these risks before they become serious enough to seriously injure the patient.
Are physicians purchasing this and using it themselves, or collecting the data, or entering the data they already have from the patients? Are doctors involved in this?
I have not seen any evidence to date that physicians in material quantities are acquiring it, but mostly I think because we're not marketing it to physicians. The physicians already have lots and lots of systems that work within the data sets that they have. This is really designed to get at that broader data set. Remember, patients go to multiple doctors, so
right,
the information that any one doctor has, it may just not be enough. So it really would be of I think, limited value to a physician, greater value if the patient were to, on their own initiative, work to gather the drug and disease information and then use it in concert with their doctor to assess these risks.
What are the prospects with the increasing computerization of medical records, that it'll become easier with or without a centralized point for doing this for doctors and patients to access their total drug use profile and protect themselves against problems that way?
It's actually becoming much easier. We're already seeing examples of that among some of our clients, where there is a group of physicians in a community. For example, a community where one of our employers pretty much have relationships with all those doctors, and there's a unifying health information system in that community. We are now seeing examples of the opportunity for a patient to take their flash drive with them, insert it in the doctor's office into the system, and it'll scan the database that's there for the entire community and update and seed medical and drug events into it, avoiding the need for the patient to enter that information themselves. And so,
of course, only their own information.
Only their own information. But as medical records become more centralized and they become more electronic, where we have, I think, an Achilles heel here, and I think it's always important to talk for a moment about the limitations and potential weaknesses of any technology, ours is, frankly, the self-report component of it. You know the old systems expression, garbage in, garbage out. So if the patient doesn't do a good job of reporting their drug use and doesn't do a good job of recalling their disease and condition history, then no matter how good our algorithms are, we're not going to accurately reflect the risk the patient has.
I don't know what the status of it is anymore. There used to be a drug called DMSO that people took for arthritis that they weren't supposed to. It was banned or semi-banned. I'm curious to know, just peripherally, anecdotally, what's the situation with that now? But more generally, are there difficulties that arise in the use of your system for people somehow either being embarrassed or ignorant or otherwise reluctant to put information that's relevant to their condition into the system?
With respect to embarrassment, we see just the opposite, where a patient might be reticent to say this to a nurse who's taking a history,
right,
or the doctor. This is done at home. This is done locked up, sequestered in someone's house, and therefore the embarrassment factor is reduced. They're less likely not to do it.
Okay.
But there is the issue of what we call recall bias. That is, they forget, or they just don't, you know, internalize that the doctor said you have this condition. Maybe they're in denial, and yes, they have hypertension, but, you know, they don't want to come to grips with it. So this is an issue, and, of course, as we begin working more and more with large insurers who have the medical claim data that they've already processed for their patients, we're hoping over time to eliminate the self-report mechanism and offer data seeding into the product through the patient's insurer. As long as the patient signs an informed consent, a fully informed consent, and says, yes, I agree and want you to do that on our behalf, this might go a long way to reducing the spottiness that can occur in self-reporting.
You're saying that this would allow the insurance company to tell the patient what drugs essentially the insurance company's been paying for.
And what diseases they've been paying claims for as well.
Because the insurance companies may have a more complete database about the patient's medical history and drug use than the patient.
Right, and all that previous technology that I told you we built between roughly 1976 and 2000 was all predicated on insurance claim-based systems. All of our prior systems entirely depended on insurance claim basis. It's now that we've moved into the consumer realm that we're dealing with this self-report mechanism until we can loop back around and bring our old insurance companies back into the fold and get them to help us seed the consumer product.
Well, are insurance companies eager, reluctant, or neutral about that?
Well, I think they're, I wish I could say they were eager, but as insurance companies typically are, they're taking a let's see what sort of traction your product has for us to build systems that electronically link between the insurance company's data processing facility and our facilities in Tampa, Florida, is a big effort for them, and it exposes them to costs as well as to certain vulnerabilities. And so
if you're part of the expression, it makes them susceptible to viruses.
Well, it does, although we can control that part of it. But it also, again, any time you start moving data electronically between point A and point B, you run the risk of snooping and of folks coming in diverting data. I mean, it becomes an issue. As we've seen in the last 6 months, very reputable companies in the credit reporting industry and
yes,
in the healthcare industry,
that's right,
have lost enormous amounts,
right,
of data. And so what I think we're hearing is, because most of these insurance companies have been our clients in the past, so they sort of understand already our technology, they're saying, okay, Lee, look, let's see what kind of traction you get. If you only have 10 of our patients in the entire country purchasing your product,
right,
we're not going to move this mountain for 10.
Right.
But if you've got 2 million, then we have a critical mass.
It would be worth our trouble to hire someone or detail someone to write the code to make it possible.
And to make it non-porous. So I think that we have an obligation to these insurers to demonstrate the consumer appetite and willingness. You know, we always think consumers want things. That's the classic marketing perspective. But indeed, what the consumer wants translated to what will the consumer pay for is a fairly substantial difference.
Right.
And though we've done all the requisite surveys and interviews, now we're at the stage of what is the consumer willing to pay for. And I think once we see that there is traction, we'll likely make a better impression when we visit these large managed care organizations.
Okay, I don't want to get too far afield here, but what we've been talking about here opens up the some other questions that maybe you could just peripherally comment on. The vast amount of information that medical insurance companies have about the treatment of tens of millions of patients, it seems to me, would be useful not just to tell an individual patient what they're taking in the way of drugs, but must have enormous application in terms of what kind of treatments are most effective and what providers and types of providers of medical treatment are most effective in reducing mortality and morbidity, aren't they?
Well, you're quite insightful. Indeed, several years ago, when we won the federal contract to build the National Clinical Practice Guidelines, the very first effort by the United States government to try to establish some commonly accepted practice guidelines to make more uniform.
Do they sort of relate to standard of care?
Yes, sir, they do. They relate to standards of care. We were chosen to do that work largely because of our experience with the roughly 20 million patient histories that we had in our system in those days. Now, these patient histories were fully anonymized, stripped of all of their individual identifiers,
right,
so that we could use them for the research purpose of saying there's three approaches to the treatment of congestive heart failure, A, B, and C.
Right.
Let's follow a cohort of people treated via A, treated via B, and treated via C.
Right.
And let's measure the incidence of hospitalization in the course of a year or 18 months or 36 months. We had about a seven-year longitudinal flow in our. So that provided a useful opportunity to look at outcomes in a fairly short period of time. We couldn't, for example, study 20-year outcomes and 30-year outcomes because we didn't have data that went that long. But for near-term outcomes, and many cardiovascular diseases have very important near-term outcomes, these databases are very powerful. And so that made up a large amount of the underlying research that we did between roughly 1976 and 2000. That represent the rules and algorithms that RxWise has today. And we were one and among the group of early entrepreneurs that demonstrated the vast power and value of these longitudinal patient insurance claim data sets.
Well, what's the current status of that, both at your company and more generally, about making available to people who have any of thousands of medical conditions to find out how the last 10 million people who've had it have been treated and which ones have worked out the best?
Well, today we're not doing that. We're focused immediately on this opportunity to empower consumers. But I can tell you that there are a growing number of organizations around the country. Some of them are some of the largest managed care companies. For example, Kaiser Permanente and United Healthcare and WellPoint/Anthem have actually built very large divisions within their company that do exactly what you're suggesting. And frankly, for them, it's easy. It's easier because those data are internally accessible.
So in fact, that data is proprietary to say, Kaiser Permanente, which wants to know how to get the best outcomes for its patients, so they can, quote, thrive. And in order to do that, it is constantly monitoring its own database to find out which treatments are working the best.
Yes, sir. That's exactly what they do. And you may very also be aware of the important announcement made by the Center for CMS, Medicare or Medicaid Systems, the Medicare agency for the federal government, which announced that with now the addition of prescription information in the Medicare database, because as you know, up until January 1st, Medicare hasn't paid for drug benefits, so there's been no drug information in the Medicare database.
And if Senator McCain gets its way, they won't be.
Well, that's a different issue altogether.
Right.
But now, when linking prescription information with the Part A, which is the hospital data, and the Part B, which is the outpatient data in Medicare, we, for the first time in the history of this country, have longitudinal outcome data on the elderly. It's absolutely inconceivable for most folks to realize that because of the fragmented way the elderly get health care in this country and the limits in Medicare with respect to drugs, we couldn't really adequately track the outcomes of pharmaceutical care within the elderly population. And frankly, it won't start until Medicare begins in January.
You say for this country, do countries that have national health programs already have all this information?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Done this?
I don't know if it's correct to say it's a national disgrace.
Could we say every industrialized country in the world except the United States does this?
No, not every. I think that might be slightly overstating it, but certainly countries that have
Germany, UK, New Zealand, Australia, Canada.
Absolutely. These countries, Canada has one of the most robust adverse drug reaction monitoring systems using the anonymized data derived from its provincial health care systems that report this data up into Ottawa. So I think that part of the payoff to the enormous expenditure contemplated in the Part D Medicare program will be eventually the ability to look longitudinally at the use of medicines in the elderly and say, it doesn't make any difference. Didn't you just see last week a report about, or maybe it was yesterday, pardon me, a report about antipsychotics?
No, I didn't see that.
Oh, it was in the New York Times. I don't mean to advertise for them.
It's okay.
The front page of the New York Times saying that studies now show that the newest, most expensive antipsychotics, which are many, many times more expensive than the older ones, now suggest that they're no more effective. And yet we have folks spending enormous amounts of money thinking they're getting the absolutely best pharmacology available.
They're getting the best advertising available.
They're getting good advertising. So I think that we don't know really long-term what the benefits and risks are to the elderly. We certainly, I think, know the risks, but we can't tie the risks to the benefits, so we keep shoveling drugs into the mouths of wanting elderly, thinking we're helping, and may A, not be helping, and indeed may be doing harm. The old saying, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Well, some of us are concerned that the Part D program may ultimately be characterized this way. We may be trying our darndest to make drugs more accessible to the elderly, only for them to take more medicines and potentially get sicker.
It goes back further than that. I understand the Hippocratic Oath features the statement, first do no harm.
Absolutely. In fact, I think that when people realize that this issue of iatrogenic, and that's where that word, the origins of that word, go all the way back to Hippocrates, iatrogenic disease is a very serious problem for medicine and has been for 2,000 years. In Hippocrates' day, the treatment was often more dangerous than the disease.
Right.
More people died of the treatment than would have died had the self-living disease been just allowed to run its course.
Okay, one little question, and then we can start wrapping up. How are new drugs, as they come off the assembly line and through FDA approval, entered into your system, and how often is it updated?
Yes, we offer, included in the prices that I described to you, full updating services, so that on the flash drive version, the consumer is sent an email with a hot link, they're asked to click on it, and that hot link immediately then begins downloading the update from our server right into their flash drive. For the web product customers, we simply move those updated files into the web-enabled product as soon as they're released by our rules development team.
So you're constantly watching what new drugs as they come onto the market.
Absolutely. And, one could hardly have been alive and reading newspapers over the past year to see the onslaught of criticism leveled against the FDA for the problems of reasonably newly released medicines, or medicines that have been released in the last 5 years. The one that comes to mind, of course, is the anti-pain medicine Vioxx,
right,
by Merck. I think what's interesting to note there, and I don't mean to be either critical of the FDA or to prejudge the issue with respect to Merck, but the early warning signs...
Actually, it's already been judged to the tune of about $253 million in Texas.
I'm not in a position to judge it based on my data.
Right.
But I think what I'm trying to suggest, though, is that early concerns and early alerts were already going off in the literature about this medicine as a result of publications and research made available outside of the manufacturer.
So, back to around 2000, actually.
Yes, sir, that's correct. So our system, you know, has indeed contained advisories advising physicians to carefully evaluate a patient's cardiovascular risk before using this medicine back to 2001.
Okay.
So we are constantly looking beyond what the FDA publishes in the drug monograph to what's occurring in the literature, because oftentimes that's the more sensitive marker that we can use to pick up these early alerts. Again, we're not advising that it not be used. We're advising that you share your cardiovascular risk factors with your doctor in the concert of the use of this medicine, and allow your doctor to help make that decision.
Okay. I also wanted to ask, when the drop-down menus drop down, do they include illicit drugs as well as herbal remedies and pharmaceutical products?
No, they don't. We don't have drugs like marijuana and cocaine. For one thing, believe it or not, there's not a lot of literature on how cocaine interacts with other diseases that people have. And
one would think there might be, it's a pretty powerful drug and might have interactive activity with other drugs.
Well, it isn't that it doesn't. I think that we felt that introducing illicit drugs into the technology to a population of folks that are already squeamish about entering anything into any system,
right,
certainly our web-based product, I can hardly imagine anyone volunteering that they were a chronic cocaine user,
right,
in filling out the history on the website.
So if they are, and that drug does interact with prescription drugs, they're not going to know about it.
Well, not through our technology, but we would of course counsel anyone that they shouldn't be on the medicines, the illicit medicines, irrespective of what prescription or non-prescription medicines they were taking. In other words, it's a parametric, obligatory contraindication in the context of you just should not be using illicit medicines, and so it's hardly a gradation of, well, this would be not as bad if you didn't have hypertension. The use of cocaine is bad for any patient. Even the healthiest patient shouldn't be on those medicines.
And I don't know whether it's an oxymoron, but it is a controversial subject. Medical marijuana, which is under California law and several other states, prescribable or recommendable by physicians, and the federal government doesn't like that, but many state governments have approved it. And it's prescribed for a number of conditions.
You know,
it's an illicit drug to the federal government, but it's a medically acceptable drug to various state governments. What's the story there?
It's a medical drug. For folks who have the discrete conditions for which that drug is medically indicated,
right,
it's enormously effective, more effective than any prescription drug we know for the alleviation of the specific issues that these people have.
Right, but it's not in your database.
It's not. I must admit that marijuana today is not in our data set.
Do you know anecdotally whether it has any adverse reactions with any other drugs, or whether, in fact, it's benign enough that it doesn't?
You know, I must admit, I don't know. We do have people in our organization who could answer that question fully, but based on my clinical knowledge, I just can't answer that question.
Okay. Finally, we started out talking about this discrete product, RxWise, that deals with drug interactions, but and adverse drug effects. But we quickly reached a discussion about massive databases and cross-national comparisons and whatnot. What's the future for your company in delving into any of these other areas as product or service offerings in the future?
Well, you know, I kind of appreciate your asking that question because we actually have a vision that began in 2001 when we started the development of this product, which sort of explains why we have the USB drive today, is that there is an emerging science called pharmacogenomics.
Right.
Pharmacogenomics portends to offer yet the best predictive markers for severe adverse drug reactions. These are, and pardon me for using such a fancy word, but these are the single nucleotide polymorphisms that represent errors, you know, the DNA codes for certain enzymes that are used for metabolizing and processing many things, including medicines. And if there's a slight distortion, if there's a slight transposition of one of those nucleotide building blocks, it can either reduce the effectiveness of these proteins or enzymes produced or completely deactivate them. And it seems that that most of the most severe adverse drug reactions can be traced back to people who both present with a pre-existing historical risk, like having hypertension, coupled by the inefficiency of their body to metabolize and get rid of the medicine that could be exacerbating hypertension. That combination guarantees, to a large extent, a hypertensive crisis. And so hopefully within the next, I would say, 6 to 9 months, we've been working on it since 2001, we are going to release a add-on to the product which will allow the patient to go to a local laboratory, one of the commercial laboratories in everyone's hometown, that will take a swab, something that sort of looks like a Q-tip, swab the inside of their mouth, swab their cheeks.
The way they do it in CSI.
Yes, exactly, right, like CSI, and mail it to a lab that has the capacity to identify whether or not patients have these sort of misspellings of their genetic code, and if they do, that information gets sent back to us and embedded into the product so that we have a set of pharmacogenomic markers to add to the sensitivity of the epidemiologic markers that we're using today. This is the most exciting opportunity to materially improve predictive strength of the models that we use. We don't want to tell somebody they're at risk if they're really not at risk, but not everybody at risk actually ends up having an adverse effect. So the trick is to go to that subset that is at risk but is indeed highly probable to present with the adverse effect, and pharmacogenomic markers will bring us, I think, eventually to that opportunity.
Now, I did an interview, I think more than a year ago, with Professor Church at Harvard Medical School, mm-hmm. who was advocating essentially individual genomic sequencing for everyone. The problem was it cost about over $1 million to do it. Are you saying that these, for among other reasons, precisely the points that you just made, are you saying that these tests for genetic markers for these heightened risks interactions will soon be commercially available at reasonable cost?
Actually, sir, they are today commercially available. A company, Roche Diagnostics, in collaboration with another group out on the West Coast, Affymetrics, that make a little chip that fits into a device that can automates this process and has brought the price down from the $1 million for genetic sequencing that Professor Church had referred to the ability to offer in this case, not whole body, whole genome sequencing, but sequencing along chromosome 19, which is the one most likely associated with the issues that affect ADR risk, for a few hundred dollars. And so,
do insurance companies cover it?
They don't yet. And as you know, insurance companies, again, as I described, tend to take a wait-and-see attitude, both in terms of traction and in terms of embrace by the medical community.
Well, it worked for Viacom by getting everyone to say, I want my MTV. Can people go out there and say, I want my genetic markers?
Well, I think they can. The difficulty in that space, as we've come to understand over the past 4 years, is the issue of actionability.
Right.
You know, telling a woman that she, and I'm just using this as an example,
right.
Or a male who has a risk, a genetic risk for prostatic carcinoma, or a woman who has a risk for breast cancer, right now there's not a lot you can do but worry once you find that information
right.
out. There's really no intervention. Now, of course, there is better monitoring and more frequent monitoring, but even that has failed to demonstrate that the ultimate course of the disease and the ultimate risk to the patient, particularly in prostatic carcinoma, changes. You know, when do you go in and take it out? You know, what's going on in the interim period? So the issue of actionability to these data, I think, fight with its cost-benefit.
That's a good point. But from what we've been talking about in terms of drug interactions and susceptibility to adverse effects, that is a very actionable item, isn't it?
Yeah, you're reading my mind exactly. So when the throw is not that far, we're not talking about 10, 20, 30 years out as you would have for some of these cancers, but 30, 60, 90 days out, that there is an actionability element, and because, as you pointed out earlier in the interview, the size of the U.S. pharmacopeia is so large, there is inevitably an alternate medication that will achieve the same therapeutic outcome that will not share that particular risk.
Right, and in fact, if the risk is elucidated through the genomic sequencing process, then you can tell the person immediately, stop taking drug A, take drug C, or do something else.
Well, exactly. In the hands of a physician well-trained to understand the risk and to look at the alternative medicines, that would be a very simple outcome. You know,
Or to have the database in front of him or her that says, we've encountered 40,000 of these this month, we've sent 20,000 in this direction, 20,000 in that direction, it's working out a lot better in plan A, put your people on that if they fall into this genomic category, and keep fine-tuning the process.
That's exactly the research that's going on. You know, I got into this space, this pharmacogenomic space, through a tragedy. In 2001, my brother's 13-year-old son died of an adverse drug reaction
that
was predictable through a genetic test. It was a reaction to an anesthetic that he was given. He was a young wrestler in middle school, and he broke his collarbone, and they brought him into the hospital to reset his collarbone and decided to save him the agony and to put him asleep for about 5 minutes or so till they could get the bone fixed.
Right.
And he died of a malignant hypothermia secondary to the administration of that anesthetic. And indeed, there is indeed a genetic marker for that, which on autopsy it was discovered he had. And indeed, my brother has. I fortunately was spared that particular genetic marker. So this is what, after our last business, I don't think we were as hell-bent to move into this consumer empowerment, consumer education with respect to ADRs, had it not been for the tragedy that befell my brother's family.
Well, I'm sorry for that, but I'm glad that it's had a good result.
Well, we hope so.
Essentially from what we've just said in the last 2 minutes then, you're hoping to branch out into this area involving pharmacogenetics and all of its implications for empowerment of patients as well.
That's correct. We just wanted to measure the traction of the product without the genetic add-on to be sure that there were enough consumers out there that would pay the $39 before we asked them to spend the $239.
Right.
And you know, our thinking was if there wasn't traction at 39, it was probably pretty slim.
Right.
The retraction at 230.
Well, what are you prepared to say about what the reaction's been so far?
Well, it's been remarkable. I must tell you that you know, we have, since we went live around June 1st, almost a quarter of a million patients that are receiving alerts through one of the various iterations of our product today, and we don't have a marketing department or an advertising department, so it's remarkable to us, and large employer groups are now beginning, starting about the 1st of September, after months and months of negotiations, discussions with them, begin offering it to their employees. We hope to have permission from our employer clients to release a press release that will you know, name them, but out of deference to their requirements for confidentiality, we can't do that without the sign-off of the various levels of legal review that such a press release would require.
So, but you'll let me know when you can, and we can talk about, we can talk again about that.
Actually, we're hoping to have something around the 1st of October, so you won't have to wait long.
Okay. That leads to the question of, is your company publicly traded or privately held?
No, it's a privately held company, and I don't contemplate in the next several years that we will be in a position to publicly offer this business. It's too evolving, and I think we're doing something too close to the very edge of comfort that there probably aren't a lot of investment bankers and venture capitalists who would feel comfortable. This is the classic no man's land that entrepreneurs find themselves in, where they're just pressing that envelope really close to the edge, and everyone's happy for the entrepreneur to use their own money to do that.
Oh, you could be surprised, though. There are some venture capitalists who like being on the edge, I think, or at least say they do. So.
Well, we've been very lucky and very fortunate in our previous businesses that we can, you know, carry it ourselves. My wife and I own the business together. She has her doctorate from the University of California in San Francisco, and we have been building these companies together for 30 years. So we're pretty used to being in this no man's land, and frankly, it's a comfortable place to be while you're still trying to figure out what works and what doesn't.
Okay. Finally, how can people who are either large employer groups or individual consumers get in touch with you to get some more information about the RxWise product?
The best way to do that is to go to our website at www.rxwise.com.
Let's spell that? The RxWise, exactly how that's spelled?
RxWise.
Right.
www.rxwise.com.
Okay.
And read about and watch the little flash presentation on what ADRs are. Unfortunately, the majority of the public doesn't really understand what an ADR is, with much less want to do something about it. So we have a really critical educational hurdle to overcome before the consumer really understands why this is important.
Okay, well, I think people listening to this will have a good background and can tell more people to listen to it and get more people have a good background and move both the theory and practice of all of these fields forward.
Well, I've been at scientific conferences where I haven't been asked as insightful questions as you've asked me today in this interview, so I think you've done a good job.
Okay, well, thanks to both of us then, and I hope to talk to you again when you get the, you're able to send out a press release about some of the participants in your program.
That's great, and thank you.
Thanks very much. Bye.